You are listening to the Preacher Boys Podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Preacher Boys Podcast. Today, I'm sitting down with a very special guest. His name is Joe Nucci. He is a therapist who specializes in anxiety, depression, and complex trauma. I started watching his content probably about a year ago, and I've really enjoyed it ever since. It's a must follow on social media if you aren't already. But on today's episode, we're going to be talking a little bit about everything relating to what has become pop psychology, everything from trigger warnings to trauma to narcissism. I want to get his takes as a therapist into how we can improve our vocabulary around so many topics relating to mental health. I really hope you'll enjoy this conversation. Be sure to stick through the entire thing. There's a really fun kind of rapid fire round at the end that you're not going to want to miss. So here's my conversation with Joe Nucci. Joe, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
You've become one of my favorite content creators to watch. I've sent your reels to so many people. My wife is bombarded with them constantly saying, check this out. What do you think about this? And I almost had to disinvite you from the show because you gave a very controversial take on Sex and the City. And are you Team Aiden? Before we get started, I want to know, are you Team Aiden? It felt like there was some Team Aiden vibes in your post.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. I guess I do have to, you know, come out as Team Aiden, although I understand why Carrie ended up choosing Mr. Big. But I have to say, my heart jumps when you made your joke, because it's like, which controversial post, quote unquote controversial post, is he talking about? I know the criticism I invite, but I like to think of myself as more kind of thought provoking and I don't think anything I say is actually that controversial. I think it's actually fairly obvious. But
okay, so I have to ask you, because we started talking about it. My wife was very upset by your reel on this.
Unpopular opinion: Carrie is actually a bigger narcissist than Mr. Big. Let's talk about it. There's a lot of talk on the internet about how Mr. Big, Carrie's main romantic interest in the series Sex and the City, is actually a narcissist. And people think that he's a narcissist because he constantly says how he's not the marrying kind, and he ends up marrying somebody much younger than Carrie. The internet describes this behavior as hoovering, which is a common tactic used by narcissists to kind of keep somebody on their hook. But I was rewatching the series recently, and it also occurred to me that, you know, Carrie cares a lot about the latest fashion labels. She only likes to go out to places in New York that are the most exclusive and the most elite. She only likes to surround herself by people that she feels are at her level in terms of eliteness. And she's also committed to a romantic ideal that, as you learn from the show, doesn't exist. In fact, when she does find a nice, securely attached guy, she actually cheats on Aiden and ends up marrying Mr. Big. I actually think Mr. Big's behavior is better explained by an avoidant attachment style and a general emotional stuntedness that most men deal with, even today. So to all the ladies out there who insist that their ex-boyfriend is a narcissist, how does it feel to have the tables turned on you? And whether you agree or disagree with my analysis here, tell me what you think in the comments. I cannot wait to talk about this one with you all.
So I said I'm going to take like 5 minutes of this. I just got to ask you some questions. What do you think of the rest of the cast, like a Miranda or a Samantha? Yeah. Or a Charlotte? When you're watching, are you constantly in that mode of like, here's what I think is really going on with them? Because, you know, yeah, Carrie to me is always kind of a side character in my mind when I watch the show. Like, I'm much more interested in all of the other perspectives happening. But yeah, give me a breakdown of a couple of the cast and where they fit.
You know, I relate to what you're saying, because in different sitcoms, I feel like I rarely relate to the main character. Like in That 70s Show, I didn't relate to Eric Foreman, but I related to the rest of them. In Friends, you know, I related to not Jennifer Aniston or Rachel. In Sex and the City, I feel the same way. I kind of see myself in Samantha and Charlotte and Miranda, but I see myself less in Carrie. For those of you who missed it, the take I had was, you know, who really is the bigger narcissist? Is it Mr. Big or is Carrie? Carrie being somebody who, you know, cares a lot about like the hottest brands and labels, who only wants to go to the coolest restaurants and surround herself with very elite people, and is committed to a romantic ideal that, as we learned in the show, doesn't actually exist. The point of the clip was less that I think that Carrie is a narcissist and more that, you know, there's so many other blogs and videos analyzing Mr. Big as a narcissist for his behavior. And I think that if you apply the same level of rigor to Carrie, you can come away with the same interpretation. And so, like much of my content, the point of that video was to kind of push people to see that it actually doesn't take that much rationalizing or intellectualizing to kind of justify, you know, this clinical term or like this, you know, therapeutic jargon in order to make your point. Do I think Carrie is a narcissist? You know, on the record, no. But I think that if all we can point to is Big's mistreatment of her throughout the show as evidence of narcissism, well, I actually don't think that's much to go on. And I actually think there's, in terms of just a pure symptom checklist, I think Carrie actually gives us more. In terms of the other characters, I love the show, by the way. I've seen the series a few different times. One of the things that I really love about the show and the characters is that it really captures personal development in a very, very beautiful way. So at the beginning of the show, Samantha, you know, is the really like kind of sex positive, like promiscuous one who like doesn't want to commit or settle down. And over time, she learns to let her walls down and actually like connect with a guy, with more than one guy, actually, on an emotional level. Charlotte is our resident, you know, perfectionist. She thinks that she needs like, you know, like the boy from a nice family. And by nice family, we need a rich family who checks this box and this box and this box. And she lets go of the idea that she needs to kind of fit this mold that society might have for her to be happy. You know, she goes with this. I mean, I remember the episode, right, where she kind of admits to herself that she actually has feelings for Harry, and she's just kind of like, oh, he's, you know, he's short and hairy and bald and rude and all these things. And she goes, and it's the most excited I've been about a guy in a really long time. And it's, and that's exactly what perfectionists have to do. You know, they have to realize that, you know, perfect is kind of like the enemy of the good or the great. And then Miranda is, you know, kind of like the workaholic and can be like archetypically like kind of more masculine, quote unquote, than some of the other characters. And even she learns to be softer, to depend on Steve, you know, to let him in. And I love watching the transformation over the seasons. You know, could I make a shoddy intellectual argument that they're all narcissists too? Probably. But that's the whole point of the clip. It's to kind of get people to think that, you know, maybe it's a little bit, you know, deeper than that, which I think it often is.
Yeah, it's really a great springboard into the larger conversation I want to have, which is we tend to lean into labels and we want to see things as black and white. Particularly, I see in the people I'm talking to often, we're former fundamentalists. And so we were taught to see the world in black and white. And I see a lot of times when we leave those environments, we start bringing that mindset to everything. And before we dive into that conversation that everyone is here for, one last selfish question for me. What's your take on And Just Like That? Do you view that as part of that world, or do you pretend it doesn't exist?
I kind of reluctantly made it through season two. I miss Samantha's character. I think that there's something missing. Something that was very, I think, special about the series was that when the girls were apart and they were kind of like the worst versions of themselves, that's where all kind of like the excitement and drama would happen. And when they came together, you got those different perspectives and it kind of became like integral or integrated, you know, in terms of it. And I don't really see that flow happen in Just Like That. It's just, it feels like a very different show. I also wish that, they had made Charlotte the one who needed to learn lessons about social justice. The idea that, you know, the progressive, you know, redheaded, you know, kind of like lawyer from season one, like doesn't understand like basic things that anyone who follows Cynthia Nixon knows that she like is very like woke, for lack of a better term. I had a harder time kind of like, you know, suspending the disbelief, like when you like sit down for a piece of fiction. I couldn't get into it. Will I watch, you know, subsequent seasons? Probably, just because I like the characters and I like a lot of what the writers do, but it doesn't have the magic for me that the original series had.
Okay. Well, now that we've gotten all this out of the way, this very important things. I had to, you posted it because I literally just told somebody, I said, it's like he tailor makes his content for me. Like I love watching everything that he puts. And then you posted that. And I was like, is this a joke? I sent it over and I was like, see, it's exactly for me.
I really appreciate that. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, what put you on my radar and what probably put you on the radar of a lot of your following was the video you put out where you said you were tired of the cult of trauma.
This is going to piss off a lot of people, but I have to say it. I am so over the cult of trauma. The cult of trauma is other mental health professionals and mental health enthusiasts on social media who assign everything to a trauma response. The allure in labeling everything as a trauma response is that you don't actually have to think, was it something else? Is it possible that it actually just has to do with your temperament? Is it possible that it has to do with biology or a chemical imbalance? Is it something that has to do with the fact that, hey man, life is hard, relationships are unfair, and people can be cruel? That does not mean that every time you encounter hardship, you are traumatized. And I think that as more and more people use the word trauma, it's going to be more important to distinguish if we're using it in a colloquial, casual way, or if we're using it in a way with clinical significance. I'm genuinely curious to get all of your opinions on whether or not this is a good or bad thing that the word has become so ubiquitous.
Can you give us the 10,000 foot view of what you mean when you say you're tired of the cult of trauma?
Yeah. So I've been in the field of personal development, broadly speaking, for many years. I worked with executive coaches, et cetera, before I went to grad school to become clinically trained. And I was in grad school when COVID hit. And you know, all of my internship patients went online, and I proceeded after grad school to open up my own virtual practice and have been practicing ever since. I started making content about a year ago, April, 2023. And I have to say, it's one of those things where it's like, I mean, did I catch, like, you know, different pieces of kind of like self-help or therapy related content? Like, I guess, but I was also just in school and I was inundated, you know, with my studies, and it just wasn't something that, I mean, I know it became very popular kind of before, during, and after COVID, but it's just not something I was particularly tracking until I started making it. My original video that went viral that ultimately had me take the media work more seriously had nothing to do with trauma or really even therapeutic language at all. It was about metacognition, and it also went viral. But the more I started to kind of look at other, because when you're an influencer, when you're a content creator, depending on the space that you're in, you're looking at other videos and like other formats and trends, and like you're kind of in that network of conversations. And I noticed that the word trauma was used pretty loosely, I guess would be the best way to put it. And there were certain claims that I saw being made on very popular posts. I mean, posts with, you know, millions of views, like your whole personality is just a trauma response. Mm-hmm. And that really bothered me as someone that's very passionate about the field. And it bothered me on two levels. One, that statement is incorrect. There are other things that go into personality, like all of the positive experiences you've had, also genetics. You know, genetics are a component of personality. And, two, there's something consequential about setting up a fundamental piece of your experience of life, like your personality, to tell the story that this is just a trauma response, all this is tragedy. I think that, well, I can't actually think of much. I can't think of many other things that are potentially as harmful from just a purely narrative perspective. Something that maybe you've caught me saying in my own podcast or my content or in other conversations I've had is, look, like when I'm with friends, like at a friend's house or at a bar, and someone is venting or they're hyperbolic and they say like, oh, that person is, you know, total narcissist, or like LOL trauma response, like they're humorous. Like I'm not a stickler about language. I think it's okay for language to kind of ebb and flow. I think it's okay to use exaggeration or hyperbole. But when you have a platform like I do, where like you're reaching, like I've had some, you know, I mean, this week has been a particularly engaging week for my content. Like I've reached like over 1 million people, you know, like, so I think that there is, for me, I do my best to like stop for a second, consider the ethics of that. And if you're misusing a word like trauma, a word that does have clinical significance, that's what I started to take issue with. So anyways, the video that you're mentioning, I talk about the cult of trauma, and I termed it that because it seemed to me that when I criticized the use of trauma in other videos, people proceeded to tell me that they would, you know, they're reporting my profile, that they're, you know, they would share me to my story and be like, everyone go report this person, or they would, you know, message me, you know, things and try to kind of, you know, inflict guilt or shame. One person actually reported me to my board, which is, I mean, the board isn't going to do anything. My media is completely separate from my private practice, and it's that way strategically. And so all the people that think they're so smart trying to find a way to kind of put the screws to me, it's just part of having a public presence, which maybe you could relate to as well. Yeah. But I also just kind of noticed, I was like, well, I'm really glad I picked that word because this is what I thought would happen, number one. And that is actually, from my understanding, and I'm not, you know, the most well-read expert on it, but that is cult-like behavior.
Yep.
You know, the dispensing of existence, I think, is what experts call it. The canceling, the don't even look at this person, block him. Block him. And so it's... I think that that's why I chose that word. And for those that haven't seen the video, the whole point of the video is there are other things that go into your psychology. There are other things that go into your mental health journey. And perhaps most importantly, just as as mental health stigma decreases, as these terms become popularized, like what do we do when we mean it in a casual way versus a clinical way or a way with clinical significance? How do we communicate that?
Yeah. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Every single day, I'm dealing with extremely heavy topics like the ones I talk about on this show. And as much as I love hearing from others, it can be easy to neglect my own mental health. And that's why I'm so thankful for BetterHelp. You guys know I don't talk about products that I don't personally use myself. And to be honest, I was really skeptical stepping into BetterHelp for the very first time. I had never really done any formal therapy. And the idea of doing video therapy seemed really intimidating and scary, and I questioned whether it would actually be helpful. Well, now I'm almost a month into BetterHelp, and I have had such an amazing experience picking an incredible therapist that's understood and really fit my needs and my schedule has been an absolute game changer for me. And so I'm a really big fan of BetterHelp, and if you're thinking about starting therapy, it's a great place to give a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your ever-changing schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I actually switched therapists after my very first appointment, and the second person that I used became someone who I absolutely loved, and I can't imagine a better therapist for what I need. So never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/preacherboys to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/preacherboys. All right, let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I think it's huge. And really the reason your content resonated with me was I had a similar thing happen where I started a show in a pretty niche area, you know, and all of a sudden you start having a couple hundred people are watching this, or a couple thousand, or, you know, and then now there's millions of people that have seen different things I put out. And then you go back 3 years ago and you say, I did not understand that well enough to have the reach that that piece of content had.
Yeah.
And, you know, I come from a background in the flavor of religious fundamentalism that I was raised in. Mental health was treated not at all. It was treated as something that was a secular way of thinking. It was a way that was not a biblical way of looking at it. I had a youth pastor that told me that people with schizophrenia were just, you know, people that were demon possessed, but incorrectly, you know, diagnosed. Like, that kind of mentality was so rampant. And I think you see people leaving my background and the pendulum swings into, okay, well, now let's talk about it, which is a good thing. Now we have this vocabulary, which is a good thing, but now we're on the other extreme where, like you said, everything is trauma. Everyone's a narcissist. Everything's a trigger. You know, all those sorts of, you know, pop psychology terms that you talk about are getting used in irresponsible ways. And I wanted to do this. I will put in the video here where you talk about that so people can watch it. I want to play for you kind of the other extreme. So 2 days ago, a clip's been circulating from a pastor who is extremely well known. Pastors, one of the largest churches in the country, 8,000 members attend every Sunday, sold millions of books. This was his take on mental health that he shared just the other day. And I'm sure you'll see why people found it troubling. So let me put it up.
Okay.
There's no such thing as PTSD. There's no such thing as OCD. There's no such thing as ADHD. Those are noble lies. To basically give the excuse to, in the end of the day, to medicate people. And Big Pharma's in charge of a lot of that. If you understand, take PTSD, for example. What that really is grief. You are fighting a war, you lost your buddies. You have a certain amount of survival guilt because you made it back, they didn't. How do you deal with grief? Grief is a real thing. But grief is part of life. And if you can't navigate grief, you can't live life. But if you clinically define that, you can give them a pill, a series of medications, and they end up in LA homeless on the sidewalk. This is, and in regard to children, it's the most deadly thing that's been unleashed on children, medication. We're trying to make clear to parents that behavior is essentially the result of choices that kids make. And if you parent them properly, they'll make right choices. But if you blame it on something other than their choices, and you identify them as having something they can't do anything about, but medicate it, you literally are turning your child into a potential, not only a potential drug addict, but maybe a potential criminal. Because they never learn how to navigate life in a socially acceptable way.
There's another extreme of the conversation to where these things don't exist. These things are just what he says are noble lies. So I guess what I want to do is look at the extreme you've addressed, which is everything is trauma. Everything is labelable. Everything is, you know, identifiable as just this black and white spectrum. And the other extreme of, you know, trauma isn't real, essentially. Mm-hmm. Where should we find ourselves in the middle of those two extremes?
Sure. Well, let's just start off with the latter extreme, just because my reaction to that video is so top of mind. One of the things that makes misinformation tricky in our current age is not that it's not the quote unquote, like the lies are being peddled and it's like, you know I'm lying to you and I'm going to make you like believe these lies. It's actually that a lot of content creators, even the ones I've criticized, some of their stuff is good, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm sure some people feel that way about me. You know, I do my best, but I'm sure there are pieces of content I put out that are less than perfect in terms of my ability to communicate a complex idea. And, that's part of the game. And so some of what he says, the first thing that I notice about that clip is some of what he says is true. Like Big Pharma is a problem. You know, something else I talk about a lot in my content is, you know, is it mental illness or is it, you know, problems of living? So I actually kind of like what he said when he was like, you got to learn how to navigate life. You know, so I think he's pointing to something true there. But then there's this other piece of what he's saying where it's, you know, it's really interesting that he gets to select grief or bereavement as a legitimate diagnosis, but not trauma. I think that they're meaningfully different. A story I like to talk about, a personal story, is I lost my father unexpectedly at the age of 11. So I had quite a bit of therapy growing up, and I had a trauma response to that event. And I had a grief response. I still deal with that grief, because grief, if anyone who's listening has experienced grief, that's never going away. That's part of me, you know, for better and for worse. There's some good things about it. There's some bad things about it. It's the complexity of the human experience, and we all have grief. You know, I do not believe that everyone has trauma, certainly not in the diagnosable PTSD sense. They don't. And so when I think about, you know, what we mean when we say PTSD, when we think about the distorted thinking, the avoidance, the hyperfixation, the dissociation, the sleep problems that come along with it, those are things that are not necessarily explained by grief. Grief may also encourage people to engage in similar behaviors, but therapists don't know how to make grief go away. They can make your trauma symptoms go away. You know, usually what you do with someone who's grieving, and I'm not a complex bereavement expert, so you know, I don't want to speak out of turn here, but one of the best things you can do for the typical grief experience is normalize and help them process. One of the best quotes about grief I ever heard was basically, you know, grief is like a well. You know, you think that if you start drinking from it, you'll never ever stop and that you'll drown, but keep on breathing it in and one day it'll run dry. And I've always thought that was so beautiful, because I've lost more than one family member, and that has completely been my experience. Trauma, different, you know? So yeah, I think that's what I have to say about the video. I also would probably add that something that probably adds to this confusion is it's not just Christians that maybe question the legitimacy of certain mental health constructs. There's also a lot of people who I like kind of put in like a new age spiritual category that mm-hmm. probably agree. There's also people from a lot of more like Eastern practices, or maybe who practice Islam or other things, and they kind of approach it the same way. And it's a completely different philosophical stance, to say the least.
Yeah. Where do labels fit in this conversation? Because I think sometimes, you know, I think critics of labeling things or diagnosis or even therapy would say, you know, once you label yourself as something, or once you label a child as something, that's a concern that was expressed on the clip and is concerned often, you know, even by listeners of my own show have mentioned that, where, you know, once you label someone, that becomes their identity. Like, that's a fear point there. Versus, I think proponents would say, you can't treat something you can't identify. You know, so labeling helps to, you know, actually start addressing those issues. And I've had therapists that are on the spectrum of, you know, not being too pathologizing everything, to, you know, just actually labeling everything and dealing with it. Like, what is the importance of labels? Do we overvalue labels? Are labels always helpful in a therapy setting? Where do they fit?
Yeah. So let's start by defining diagnosis, and also defining identity. So a diagnosis is a symptom cluster or constellation, and it is used to inform a treatment plan. That is what a diagnosis is for. And that's why I'm not the biggest hater on the DSM or diagnostic labels in terms of when I practice, because if I want to purport myself as an evidence-based practitioner, as someone that understands the literature, and I have read literature on how to treat anxiety, let's say generalized anxiety disorder, well, you know, I know that all of the people in those studies, you know, fit a certain symptom cluster. And so people that practice and shirk the diagnostic label, what I like to ask them is, well, where do you ground your expertise in? You know, because you can't boast yourself as someone who is scientifically trained and also shirk diagnosis. That's not how it works. A really informed practitioner who shirks diagnosis might tell you that, in order to qualify for those studies, you have to fit a very specific shaped box. And most of the patients that come into a typical private practice don't necessarily fit that box. There's more than one thing going on. And I think that's true, but I think it's a both and type thing. I don't think it's, well, because it doesn't fit perfectly, we can't actually use this evidence or use anything that we know to our advantage. So diagnostic categories are, so there's like classical categories, which is something like a triangle, or like water is like H2O, you know, two hydrogens and an oxygen. If you don't have three sides and three angles, you don't get to be a triangle. Right? Mm. But what's weird about mental health categories, they're not classical categories. There's something called family resemblance categories. And a family resemblance category is more like a color. So if I say blue, well, do I mean cerulean? Do I mean navy? Do I mean baby blue? Like blue means like all these different things. And, you know, I think it's something like, I'm not going to remember this perfectly, but it's something like there's, you know, 15 symptoms for like depression in the DSM, but you only need 9 of them for more than 2 weeks to fit the criteria of major depressive disorder. So that means that you could have two people that have, for the most part, not overlapping symptoms, and they're still being diagnosed this way. Hmm. Why? Well, the way that researchers have started to put it together is they've said, okay, but because the different treatment modalities that we know might work on depression still work for these two people. Now, there's not just one treatment modality for depression, because you also have to remember, the field is very new. I mean, it's only like a few generations old. And so we learn more, I mean, really every day, but you know, every year we come out, and the way I understand cases now is different than how it was in grad school. So that's my kind of download on diagnosis and why I think it's helpful. And all that said is, you know, I don't accept insurance in my private practice, so I'm not required to give a diagnosis. And I typically do not. Because most people don't fit those neat little categories. But sometimes someone comes in and it's like, you have PTSD. And I put it on their chart because if they need to go file for disability, you know who's going to care about their diagnosis? You know, their disability insurance. And I wouldn't be doing my job if I just didn't put it in there. You know,
because you don't believe in labels, you know. Yeah,
exactly. You know, that I think that would be unethical. And so that is my little download on diagnosis. Now let's talk about identity. Like, what's identity? Identity is something that people think is subjectively defined, but it's not. It's socially negotiated. So for an example, gay and lesbian are identities, and some people say it's like, well, like that's no one else's business. Like, why do you have to identify that way? Well, it may not be your business because you're not in a relationship with them, or you're heterosexual, or you, that goes against your beliefs, like whatever it is. But someone out there wants to date that person, or, you know, hook up with that person or something. So it matters to them, like that it's, and in that negotiation, like, I want to be with you and I can't be with you, whether it's because of your different sexual orientations or romantic proclivities or religious beliefs or whatever it is, it immediately becomes this social negotiation. And that's why people identify as those things. Hmm. And so when people use a diagnosis as part of their identity, you know, that's how you know they're using it as part of their identity, because it comes up in the social negotiation. Can we talk about this difficult thing? No, that'll activate my trauma. I have PTSD. I'm traumatized. It's kind of like, okay, in this case, they're using their identity to, you know, negotiate a relationship in which they can avoid a hard conversation.
Hmm.
You know, versus, can you hold my snake for me while I clean out its cage? It's like, actually, like, I've been diagnosed with a phobia, and like, no, you know? Sure. And so it kind of, when people have diagnoses, there's kind of this inherent, one foot could be, you know, in identity, when someone is negotiating their identity, one foot could be in diagnosis because it might affect their social relationships. But on the other hand, I'm very fond of the saying that, you know, diagnoses are things that you have because they inform a treatment plan. When you properly diagnose somebody, it is often a great relief to them if you're able to do it properly. I'm thinking of someone that I diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, and they were completely relieved because it was like their experience was like, oh my God, I just realized I said that. And you have a lot of people who believe, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Yes. I'm not, well, you know, I was raised a good Christian boy. So I know the 10 commandments, but I'm not that person that gets diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. They might say to themselves, oh my goodness, I'm not as crazy as I thought. There's a name for what is quote unquote wrong with me. And there's research and there's people that have gone into remission from this. Like, how hopeful is that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I think all that context is really important, because to answer your question, how do we use those labels correctly? Well, we have to think, what are they being used for? Are they being used for to negotiate a social connection or relationship? Are they being used to inform a treatment plan? Like, are you aware? Like, I have ADHD. I practice my executive functioning skills. I sometimes do take medication. I have figured out how to kind of hack my diet and supplement regimen, so I don't need as much medication. Like, I have done my work on my mental health journey. And most people who meet me, unless you're really looking for it, you probably wouldn't notice that I have ADHD features, you know? And that's how you know that diagnosis was right for me,
sure.
Because it ultimately helped me. And so I hope that helps give more clarity.
Yeah, no, it's very helpful. I'm curious, because you talk a lot about resilience in your content, and you talk a lot about, you know, even with what you just said, it sounds like a diagnosis or a label, because I think some people are armchair diagnosing themselves, watching TikTok videos going in. And I don't want to downplay too much, because I think it's really great that some people are realizing that they grew up in abusive homes, you know, legitimately, because they're, you know, seeing information about the traits of an abuser or things like that. However, it sounds like when you are aware of a label or diagnosis or something like that, it sounds like the most effective ones should be empowering you with that information, not crippling you with that information. In terms of, like you said, someone with ADHD, I've had many friends who've been diagnosed who say, oh my goodness, now I understand why I do the things I do, or now I understand how to use that as a superpower and not as something that is crippling for me. Where do we go in the arena of, you know, trigger warnings are another thing that's become very popular. Like, content includes a trigger warning, or certain conversations you're not supposed to have because someone will say, hey, that triggers this response because I have experienced this thing. Like, what's the balance between respecting people's, you know, sense of safety and, you know, boundary, and also having tough conversations that just happen to be emotionally tough conversations?
Yeah. Well, people don't like hearing this, but a meta-analysis came out next year and found that trigger warnings have little to no impact on the people they purport to protect. Hmm. Some of the studies found that they kind of geared people up to be emotionally activated. But if you really read into the lines of the study, one of my concerns is that the word trigger is used synonymously with feeling emotionally activated. And they're not the same thing. A PTSD trigger in a more kind of extreme manifestation can seriously dissociate someone, you know, for hours or for a day. And so if we had been more responsible with the precision of our language sooner, I think trigger warnings could not just be effective, but really valuable part of society. But that's not how they're used. Mm. They're used to say you might encounter some upsetting content, but we already had that with content warnings, you know?
Yeah,
like,
right.
like when you start, I mean, maybe not now because we're in the age of Netflix, but I remember like when it was like cable, it would be like before a movie, it was like, this movie depicts, like, you know, has depictions of abuse
smoking.
Or violence or smoking or like whatever yeah. it is, like, just so you know. And then you were kind of like, okay, like, thank you. And it doesn't give anything away from the story. Trigger warnings to me kind of, they kind of tell you how to interpret the story a little bit, which I think is, you know, performative at best. And, again, potentially harmful at worst. When someone has PTSD, like here's the vision I see, like, let's say trigger warnings in academia, just as an example, the vision I would like to have for mental health and culture is that if you are working through a trauma response and you know that certain content might be triggering to you, for the professor, for the class, for everyone who considers themselves an educated person on this topic, to say, okay, and we are happy, you know, to let you kind of step out of the room to regulate, you know, or whatever it is. But what you do with someone with PTSD is you gradually expose them until the stimuli doesn't become distressing anymore. Hmm. I would actually argue that all forms of therapy are a form of exposure. Whether you're pushing past defenses or getting people to rewire their beliefs, it can be emotional, it can be difficult for people to make those changes, but a skilled therapist knows how to kind of hold your hand through that. And so if I missed something about one of your questions, but
no, I was just curious because I know that's something where, you know, I've had people on my content, which I have a trigger warning at the top of the show that says we often talk about sexual abuse, because if someone stumbles across the podcast, I don't want that to be a surprise. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. But I've also noticed, you know, I've had people get upset at pieces of content that show, say, a preaching clip, and the intonation of the speaker reminds them of a abusive, domineering pastor that they sat under, you know. And but I sit there trying to weigh that, where it's like, okay, I want to anticipate what could be triggering to some in my audience, but also triggers are very much a personal responsibility. Like, there's things in the world that, mm-hmm. you know, when you read When the Bible Keeps the Score, it gives the example of seeing someone who's wearing the clothing of a person who assaulted you. You can't mm-hmm. expect everyone in the world to not wear that clothing. You know, like, there's right. things like that. So I was just curious your perspective, because at times I find it to be, again, like, it feels almost performative, although the intention originally was a good thing, I thought, or helpful. Yeah. But now I do feel mm-hmm. it sets people up to go, what's going to piss me off about this video? You know?
Right. I mean, my take on that, both as a therapist, but also as just not just a citizen of the world, but someone recently introduced me to the term of, like, how do you be an ethical, like, digital citizen, like a citizen of the internet, yeah. Which I thought was very, which is just emerging right now. Like, we're still figuring that out. Like, you and I in this conversation are figuring that out with people yeah. who listen. My personal stance in all three of those domains is that if you are at, and I mean it with such compassion, you know, if you are in a place in your journey where someone who reminds you of the person who caused you suffering is causing a trauma response or PTSD trigger, you should talk to someone. You know, I've treated quite a bit of PTSD, and the likelihood that it will the trigger will cease, or at least decrease to the point where you might feel activated, you might feel uncomfortable, but you won't be triggered, is very, very high. And for those treatment resistant cases, or people that have really had, some people have had such a tough go of it, man. I mean, you can't even, yeah. you know, maybe you can, but you just can't believe what some people have gone through. The research that's coming out around, MDMA for PTSD is very, very exciting from a clinical perspective. Going back to that clip of the pastor, I thought it was funny. There is no pill for PTSD. They'll probably prescribe you a mood stabilizer or an SSRI, or even like some sort of anticonvulsant to kind of calm your nervous system down and cover up the symptoms. But there isn't one, you know?
Yeah.
Not in any technical sense.
Right. Yeah. I was curious about that. I shared a story recently. I was at an airport. I encountered a pastor, who was at all the conferences I was at as a teenager, you know, and I'm constantly covering these stories. I'm in this space and, like, navigating the weight of those stories while also covering them as a content creator is a whole nother conversation. But I saw him and I said, my heart rate increased. I got a little bit sweaty. My hands got a little bit shaky because it was a reminder of this other world that I've been removed from for so long. But, like, from everything I've read, I can't even identify that necessarily as a trigger, because it wasn't debilitating. It was something that made me extremely uncomfortable. I reminded myself of the reality of who I am now and that he has no control over my life as it exists. But I think a couple of years ago, I would have just said, oh, that was a triggering moment for me. While that's not really necessarily an accurate use of the word from my understanding.
Well, I also think as well, people need to keep in mind that our nervous systems are plastic. Our brains are plastic. And, you know, I brought up earlier in the episode, you know, getting some hate for a certain post. You know, when I first started creating content, I would look at the comments, particularly the negative ones, and you could ask my friends. They were, shout out to my friends if any of them end up listening to this. They were so patient with me for those first few months, because I would call them in the middle of the day and be like, can you believe this? Like, oh my God. And now, like, I get a message. I'm like, whatevs. Like, thanks for the engagement, bro. Like, right. Like, on with my day. Like, you yeah. know what I mean? Like, you think
that's going to work well in the algorithm, you know?
No, totally. I'm like, if you're as sophisticated as you think, you actually wouldn't be giving me a boost there. But all of that to say is that the over time, what I did, and because I have this awareness from both my own therapy journey, but also being a practitioner, is I was like, because people say, oh, just don't look at the content or don't look at the comments. It goes, no, I'm going to read them. I'm going to read them until it's no longer activating to me. And that is easier said than done. You know, intellectually, that's very easy to understand that it's like, oh yeah, the more you read it, the more you get used to it. But that process, you know, you might need a little bit of support on, and I believe any competent therapist knows how to help you find that pace.
Yeah. So that's great. Okay. I have a couple, I know we're almost at the end here. I have a couple like kind of rapid fire listener questions. If it's too broad a answer where it's not good to do a rapid fire answer, just let me know and we'll skip. I'm going to skip this one because I already know the answer to that. How should someone find a therapist that deals with religious trauma? I know many in my audience have said that they feel like they're educating their therapist on like what religious trauma is, or they're having to explain their background. How can you find a therapist that best meets those needs specifically?
Ooh, that's really, really, that's a very, very good question. I have a friend and colleague here in New York who is not just a clinical social worker, but he's a minister. And I know that a lot of, you know, ministers and priests, like, et cetera, like, I do know a lot of them will go on to kind of get clinical counseling degrees or some sort of the equivalent. So I would say that, you know, if you're having trouble looking for just that search term, religious trauma, look at the bios and see if they mention that they're also affiliated with that. I do believe on the different postings like Psychology Today or Good Therapy, you can actually mark that you're that you like work with Christians or like you work with, or like you're like quote unquote like religious friendly. That could also be a good way to start filtering through some of them. But the best thing you can do is ask in the consult and you say, have you worked with this before? Hopefully the therapist is honest, and I turn people away in my consults all the time, but that's also up to the therapist's marketing to help them find that match as well.
Thoughts on EDMR?
EMDR is, I've seen it work really brilliantly for, I'm not a practitioner of it, but I've seen it for patients who want to try it. I've seen it work amazing. It has had amazing results. I've seen it have no effect on people. I've seen it. It's rarer than those other two categories. I've seen it make people worse. I think that the thing about EMDR that people have to understand is it's the big debate about it is really in the scientific community. I think the typical therapist will acknowledge that it works for some people, and even if we don't totally understand why or how, that's because you know, scientists are arguing over how to measure this construct versus that construct. To me, that's kind of beside the point. I have been trained in clinical hypnotism, which is very similar to a lot of EMDR techniques. And that is, you know, people used to laugh at that even 5-10 years ago. And then Andrew Huberman did one podcast on it. And now it's like legit science, you know what I mean? And so I think, those are kind of my broad thoughts on it. I do eventually want to take the training. Maybe when I do, you can have me back and I'll have a more nuanced answer for you.
Yeah, would love to. How do you deal with people who refuse to acknowledge the existence of, say, narcissistic disorders or other things like that? Like a parent who says, you know, I'm fine, this is just the way I am. Or, you know, like, how do you engage with people who refuse to even step foot in a therapist's office and it's affecting you?
Yeah, it's... such a lovely question. The old therapist joke is, you know, how many strings does it take to change the light bulb? Well, does the light bulb want to change? It's a fallacy that I know how to fix people. I don't. I help them fix themselves faster, you know? And so that's the first thing. If the intention and the insight, isn't there, it isn't necessarily there. One thing that I will say about, one thing I will say about dealing with narcissistic people, if it's a parent or it's someone you're not willing to cut out from your life, is if you're certain if you're certain they're deeply narcissistic, well, then you have a pretty straightforward guidebook on how to be with them skillfully. Hmm. You know exactly what's going to light them up and what's going to piss them off. Because if it's truly personality disorder, it's very predictable, most of the time. So I would say that if that, that's one question to maybe, or one conversation to have with your therapist as you figure out how to do that. But, one of my specialties clinically is the adult children of dysfunctional families. That often includes a family member with a personality disorder or a, or some, kind of mental health condition. And so, what do I talk with those, with my patients about? It's a lot about, another buzzword here, but a lot about boundaries, but not just the boundary of what kind of conversation do you have with that person, but internal boundaries. Earlier when I described, when I see a comment that disapproves of me, I don't necessarily get all twisty about it. That's an internal boundary, Okay. So that stranger on the internet thinks I'm fill in the blank. They don't get to make me feel guilty or ashamed for posting that.
No.
Right. That's my boundary. And so that's something I work on with everyone to a greater or lesser extent.
That's great. Okay. We have 3 minutes. I'm going to try in 60 seconds. I just want to get factor cap on a couple quick statements. So just okay. Hot take. Is it factor cap? Everyone should see a therapist if possible.
Therapy can help everybody, but it's not a requirement for every single person.
Never see a therapist who is not in therapy themselves.
Yes. Well, they have to at least have been to therapy before. I don't think that they necessarily need to be in it currently.
Unlicensed counseling can be a safe alternative to therapy.
It depends on the issue.
In-person therapy is better than virtual.
It's not true.
Therapy should stop when you feel better.
Maybe, but feeling better isn't always a sign that therapy is working.
Dr. Melfi was a good therapist.
My last name is Nucci, so my formal answer to that has to be no comment.
Can't speak against the family. No, thank you so much for joining me on this episode. I really appreciate it. For anyone that wants to connect with you and see more of your content, what is the best way for them to do that?
At Joe Nucci Therapy. That's N-U-C-C-I, Gucci with an N.
Perfect.
On all platforms, mostly on Instagram.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.